Good evening. Welcome to the Celery Report. Today is May 22nd, 2014. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Upcoming events, we have a lunch in Marin County, Northern California, June 22nd. It's Lunch with Catherine for subscribers. And June 28th, 29th, I'll be at the Secret Space Program and Breakaway Civilization Conference in San Mateo. I hope if you're in Northern California, you can join us for one or both of those events. Our theme tonight is a great quote from Cavour. He was speaking about Garibaldi. He said, to be a hero, you must first survive. Lawrence Gonzalez, wonderful interview this week. He says, quote up on the blog, trouble comes to us all. And it's true. In times of change, we all need to be good at survival and have the confidence to know we're good at it. We know how to do it. Lawrence has a lot to inform us on that topic. Money and markets, the politics of a bipolar world continue to emerge. Hands down, the most important story this week, a very significant precedent, our leadership, Americans' leadership in legal terrorism. The sheriff of Nottingham took a new aggressive turn. The U.S. indicted five in China's secret unit 61398 for cyber spying on U.S. firms. Is that calling the pot calling the kettle black? Monday's indictment is the first that the U.S. has filed against a state actor for cyber theft, says Attorney General Eric Holder. He cited the need for an aggressive response. Obviously, no one's expecting a trial. The gentleman safely tucked away. But when you look at this on top of the Russian sanctions, particularly against people close to Putin and legislators, we're talking about something that's really the Midianite thing, as I call it, getting out of hand. We are all doing these things, and it's a new wave that started about 20 years ago of taking criminal charges and applying it to somebody who's acting on behalf of a sovereign government. We've been doing it here in the United States. You know, that was what was used against me during the sort of battle over engineering up the housing bubble. But we're watching targeting individual actors acting as part of their governmental duties being targeted by criminal laws. And the problem is here, if you look at the people implementing those actions, they have a long history of corruption and cronyism themselves. So my impression of Eric Holder is he's not someone who believes in the law or feels bound by it other than as a tool to be used to affect politics and force. This all gets back to soft weapons. One of the reasons people like Holder and Obama were chosen is that American and African-American faces a much more effective front for an economic warfare machinery, including one that's implementing genocide against minority populations. That's why Holder was so effective in the sweep to sort of round up kids, throw them into prison, and get the private prison thing going. So this kind of legal terrorism, as I said, has been expanding for the last couple decades, and this is taking it to a whole new level, especially when it's backed up with a covert capacity for surveillance and physical harassment. But when you use it against sovereign governments and military, the potential for blowback is very significant because you're personalizing it and creating enormous incentives for people to really make the fight personal. Putin has been very astute in his reliance and attention to international law and basing his approach on the values of the church. Pope Francis has been very focused on similar kinds of things. There's no one in the United States who can speak with this kind of authority, and that makes it a very dangerous business that we're about. Of course, we see China and Russia enter into a 30-year deal, signing a $400 billion gas deal this Wednesday. Now, that gives Moscow a big replacement market for what they're losing in their closeness and their ties to Europe, which has traditionally been Moscow's main energy market. Of course, this means very big investments in pipelines and other infrastructure that's very much going to tie the Chinese and the Russians. Much chatter about this is sort of the end of the dollar. I don't believe it. If anything, you see Russia probably pricing this deal at lower than what they're currently getting from Europe. But it's quite a healing of the Sino-Soviet rift, which has been very strong, and clearly is going to sort of improve a little bit of the hole that the events in the Ukraine have left in the Russian budget and the Russian economy. So it's all moving towards the rebalancing of the global economy in the long run. But this is clearly much stronger ties between the Russian and the Chinese. And so this bipolar world where China, Russia, and the United States continue to dance around each other, it wouldn't surprise me to see if the squabble over the South China Sea and our support of Japan, the Philippines, and Vietnam being part of why the Chinese finally did do this deal. But it's clear, if you look at the pricing, it looks to me like they were able to squeeze Putin a fair amount and take advantage of the situation. I have a commentary up on the blog. Proof positive Fed governors do not shop for groceries. We have a statement from the April 29th to 30th meeting, the minutes released in Washington, saying, you know, no concern that their policy is causing inflation. And you say, so I said, clearly they don't shop for groceries. I had posted last week the commentary on the producer price index and the incredible increases in the prices of food. What we're seeing in terms of basic expenses is significant. The deflation, if it is incomes, and that's as a result of the compromise of online systems and their use for economic warfare on top of everything else. So no need to worry about income inflation. Jim Poplava over at Financial Sense has a very interesting article. He calls it the 7 Megatrends, and it's amazing how it echoes our annual wrap-up and the first quarter wrap-up. 6 of his trends were ones that we highlighted. 1 is the domestic energy renaissance. 2, manufacturing renaissance. Has a list from somebody at Schwab of all the companies that have moved capacity back into the United States worth looking at. Revolution in education, we talked about transformation of retail, we've talked about development of the Central Corridor. I called it the digital heartland. He points out the atrophy of other parts of the country that we've been talking about with the parts of the country that are doing 3.0 doing very well, the parts of the country still stuck in 2.0 not doing well. And then another one is accelerating advancements in technology, which we've talked a lot about as well. He doesn't, that I know of, mention space. And one of the things he talked about is the dominance of the U.S. financial markets. The U.S. financial markets are losing market share. They're going to continue to be powerful, but they are going to continue to lose market share as the global economy rebalances. But it's very interesting to see Jim line up with the same trends that we've had in the last 2 wrap-ups. And those are mega trends, and they're very, very important for each one of us to understand. We'll be talking and highlighting about them more in the second quarter wrap up. Invasive communication systems everywhere you go. Edward Snowden has helped educate us all into what this means in terms of the global economy and our personal powers. I put a book review up of a new book called The Curtain by Patrick Ord. It's kind of beach reading, but it really helps you understand the impact of the data and sort of the way the game is played. So it's very useful in terms of helping you get into what this is doing to all our lives. And then I also finished, and I'll put a review up on the blog, Glenn Greenwald's notebook, No Place to Hide, Edward Snowden, the NSA and the U.S. Surveillance System. I'd read a lot of Greenwald's pieces, but it's very useful to have the story in one book and go through it together. And it gives you a good sense of how deeply disturbing, again, the U.S. surveillance system is. It's frustrating. I was also this week looking through all of our budgets for telecommunications and internet systems, and prices continue to go up, 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 while the quality continues to go down, down, down. Not to mention these are really pipelines used to destroy our privacy. So we're basically paying a whole bunch of telecommunications and software companies who are basically stealing our data and turning it over to the government, lying to us about it. It's very, very frustrating to find yourself deeply dependent on wholly compromised systems. The Greenwald story, you always have the feeling that you're only hearing half the story. Because of my personal experiences dealing in these kinds of situations at a very intimate level, you know, of course, my question is, there's no way Snowden could do this without having a huge air cover. Not to say that he understood or knew that, but you kind of feel like the deeper story is left out. And there's a lot of why, wherefores, and who's really controlled that are just not in Greenwald's story, but in terms of illuminating the NSA system, very useful. And I think this story has been very significant in producing sort of the bipolar shifts that we're seeing. There is real trouble in mortgage land. The Federal Housing Finance Agency, who now has regulatory responsibilities for many things, including Freddie and Fannie, implied that their mortgage bond task force still had many more probes to go. These probes being used by the Department of Justice to basically shake down a lot of the financial institutions for big settlements. Of course, no individuals being penalized or going to jail. We reserve that for Chinese members of the cyber hacking task force. But American officials or banks who steal from Americans, you know, no problem. Now, of course, the federal government has real problems, since clearly they were as guilty, if not more guilty, as the big banks in engineering the housing bubble and all the sort of mortgage fraud. Anyway, but the going around and around on fraud continues, and we see one mortgage servicer now announced in their servicing deals that you're not allowed to say bad things about them publicly. So to get a mortgage, you have to gag yourself in terms of criticizing of them if they should defraud you later on. This is quite amazing, since I'm certainly somebody who's had terrible problems with servicers, and I, of course, talk about some of it on the radio. The Fed's got a problem because housing is sort of cooling off, and a lot has been done both in the Fed talk and announcements from the federal regulators that they're going to loosen terms on new mortgages. The reality is that you now have investors who've got big, big positions in single-family housing and multifamily too. They want to do IPOs or securitize their portfolios. That's a problem if the housing market cools or the stock market cools. They need both to be hot. And so there's going to be a lot of political pressure this year, and then coming into the presidential election year, because those guys are big donors, particularly on the Democratic side, on both sides, but particularly on the Democratic side. So there's going to be a lot of pressure to do whatever it takes to juice up the housing markets. Markets were tough over the last week. They continued to chop sideways, up, down, up, down. One of the challenges for the S&P is you're seeing the real bricks and mortar retail chains struggling on earnings. We saw a lot of the retailers off this week, Staples, Office Depot, others. What's very interesting is if you look at consumer staples versus consumer discretionary being the more upscale, obviously the discretionary is underperforming the staples. When people get worried about the economy, more money tends to shift to the staples. But what's interesting is if you look into the food markets, we see the fresh food grocers absolutely getting crushed. If you look at the stocks of Whole Foods, Fresh Market, Sprouts, all these guys, they're getting crushed compared to the older mainline grocery stores like Kroger or Safeway. And the spread is pretty wide. And you almost wonder, what's the deeper story here? Is this divergence temporary, or is the real pressure coming related to the struggle over GMO? We're going to have Jeffrey Smith on in 2 weeks. We're going to be talking about fresh food and sort of the state of politics there, and we'll get into the deeper fundamentals in the industry. Our hero this week is Sir Ernest Shackleton. He's the subject of also the documentary I chose for our movie of the week. Sir Ernest Shackleton was an explorer. He was the polar explorer. He led 3 British expeditions to the Antarctica. His second expedition is the story of the documentary The Endurance, which was the name of their ship that was sailed in the second expedition. The second expedition ultimately was not successful. However, Shackleton's success and leadership in bringing many of his men home safely is one of the most incredible stories of survival and one of the most inspiring stories of leadership you will ever hear. I don't want to give away too much of the story. I want you to watch the documentary. Absolutely beautifully done, phenomenal. One of the things they did was they managed to take pictures and bring them back despite all of the the hardships. And so the story is told using many of the photographs that they were able to take and save. I'll just read you Shackleton's ad to raise up the crew for that second expedition. This is the ad he ran in the paper. Men wanted for hazardous journey, small wages, bitter cold, long months of complete darkness, constant danger, safe return, doubtful honor and recognition in case of success. Sir Ernest Shackleton, how's that for a marketing plan? Anyway, Endurance, you absolutely have to see it. Very inspiring. We have lots of questions in Ask Catherine, so I'm just going to dive in. Hi, Catherine. Just listen to your discussion with Joseph Farrell. Thank you for the high intelligence you bring to these subjects. I'm frankly confused by the following elements in our national global story. The subscriber then goes into a whole series of questions, which I'm going to run through and try and handle relatively quickly. Is our country bankrupt? I keep coming across statements that the U.S. has been bankrupt at least since FDR. Depends on whether you mean bankrupt in a financial sense or bankrupt in a legal sense. We're obviously not bankrupt in a financial sense. We operated a deficit, but then we print more paper and everybody takes it in exchange for natural resources for cheap. It's sort of a racketeering model. But as long as we're still cash flowing, in one sense, we're not bankrupt. Now, the other thing is, if you look at the financials, the amount of money that's been disappearing is quite extraordinary. And of course, if you want to take that money we've been tithing and throw it on our balance sheet or the assets that are produced, I can assure you we're far from bankrupt. Now, as a legal matter, was the entity or the U.S. government heading into the Great Depression technically bankrupt? No way to tell. You can spend a lifetime going down the rabbit hole of what the legal structures of the country and its cash flows and budgets really are, and I'm sure you can spend a lifetime doing it. You'll never get anywhere. And part of the problem is we have many legal structures in this country which are clear, and we don't follow those laws and obey them anyway. So we are clearly operating outside the law. And so I'm not sure necessarily that spending a lifetime trying to figure out what the law is going to help you. But I don't know. I certainly don't know a way to get to the bottom of it on an economic basis. Second question, is it true that all of our federal taxes go to the City of London and to the Vatican? The taxes that we take in, both from individuals and corporations, are significantly less than what we spend. So, you know, I'm not saying I couldn't prove or not prove that London or the Vatican have a gross pledge, but the reality is we're spending more money than we're taking in taxes. Is the U.S. a corporation or a constitutional republic? The country is a constitutional republic. Some or all of the cash flows, however, may be organized through or in corporate form. I've never been able to get to the bottom of it and finally decided it was not a good use of my time. Again, as I said, the money is run entirely outside of the law, and there's very little relationship between our real financial management and what the law says, and that's part of the challenge and why things seem Orwellian. The question continues, it is established that for 100 years, the American people unknowingly have surrendered the control of the currency, and thereby the value of our labor and creativity, as well as our peace of mind and dreams for the future, to a handful of families who own the Federal Reserve. This means we lost our sovereignty 100 years ago and have been harvested ever since. Why then do we discuss the market as if it were anything but a sham? The harvesting has gone on from long before that. I mean, if you go back through history, this is a harvesting that's been going on for thousands of years. If you just look at the history, I went back and studied the history of my family. My family's been moving around the planet trying to get away from the tapeworm for 500 years. So this is much older, but it is true that the creation of the Federal Reserve, plus the IRS, plus the drug wars in the beginning, drug laws and then drug wars at the beginning of the century made that harvesting much deeper and worse. I would not say that this has been unknowingly. Again and again, numerous people and leaders have come forward to warn people about this. And yet, we have never seen opposition rise up in sufficient strength at the same time to turn it around. But I would assure you, if you go back and you listen to my story about the red button problem, what you will understand is I think many Americans feel like they're a prisoner of the red button problem. And I would also say that the covert operations targeted at people who try and talk or do something about it are far greater. Reading Glenn Greenwald's book helps you to understand that issue. Is the U.S. under a state of emergency? This too seems to have begun under FDR and has never been ended by the administration since. Good question. I don't know about the one starting in the Depression, but often on the Constitution has been suspended, or emergency powers and national security law have been used, you know, to basically circumvent any law you and I could ever think or know about. So, yes, you know, these stratagems are used, and then there are emergency powers that came out of 9/11 that, again, are still, to my knowledge, a problem. Next part of the question, it is accepted knowledge now that the ones who are responsible for the current state of humanity are determined to eliminate at least 2/3 of the human population. I don't think that is the case, that it is accepted knowledge. You know, I think my opinion is I can't find an explanation for a combination of many things, some of which the questioner asks, like GMO foods, fluoride, chlorine, mercury, vaccines, the cancer industry. I can't come up with a hypothesis that explains all of those things without presuming that there is a desire to manage and lower the population from what it would be otherwise. But I don't think that's commonly known. What alternatives do we have? There are many alternatives. All we have to do is push the red button. We need a critical mass of people willing to do it. And that starts first and foremost with spiritual consciousness, because I think at the root, what we're dealing with first and foremost is spiritual warfare. And it's going to have to be won in the spiritual realm before you can bring that solution down to earth and win in the material world. Final part of the question is, $40 trillion has been stolen from us. The nation's infrastructure and quality of life are deteriorating. Our money is worthless. That's not true. It's not worthless. It's certainly debased, but it's not worthless. And our political, industrial, military, intelligence, financial complex is about to succeed in achieving its goal of full spectrum dominance. I'm not so sure I believe that. I just, as I've said many times, I don't think you can manage an entire global economy and culture on force, not to say that these guys aren't going to try, while ruining the biosphere, dooming billions to starvation, and manipulating the world's citizens deeper into abyss of debt, delivery, and despair. I have to ask, when will those who have the stature, intelligence, and mental grasp of our plight, when will those who have the stature, intelligence, and mental grasp of our plight come together to tell the people what is happening to them and what they can do about it? Many, many people of stature, intelligence, and mental grasp of our plight have made tremendous efforts to tell people what is happening and what they can do about it. And for a variety of reasons, it has not yet caught on. And we can talk about that and have talked about that on the Soleri Report. But each one of us needs to not wait for some great leader. We need to act. Now, there's something I always say when I'm being a tough guy, and I'm going to say it now. If I got on the internet and I sent an email to, you know, two friends, and I said, I explained a paragraph how every man could have as many erections as he wanted and every woman could have as many orgasms as she wanted. And I said, under no circumstances, promise me you won't tell anybody this. I always ask people how long would it be until everybody in the English speaking world had a copy. So what I'm telling you is if people want information, it will go. Okay. And that's what you need to understand. There have been many, many people of great stature, intelligence, and mental grasp who have warned about the plight and suggested things we can do. And I think the question is, when is a critical mass of people in terms of their consciousness and in terms of their actions going to do them? And when enough are clear enough and ready to act enough, something will happen. While we're looking in the attic of the Secret Empire, don't forget to check out the basement of the Secret Empire. Richard Souter makes mention, they give a link to a video of the 59 billion missing from Hutt. You remember that, Catherine? Yes, good point. There's a great deal of money that has gone into underground bases and facilities And so I'm sure some of the missing money has gone underground, not just into space. Hi, Catherine. Have you seen the new Johnny Depp movie, Transcendence? It's a perfect fit for Mr. Kurzweil's work. Mr. Borg himself, in an interview televised on the Science Channel, Mr. Kurzweil said the technology to merge human and machine is here. The only reason it has not been implemented is we can't be sure who will be in charge yet. To make a long story short, a possible mechanism for this merger is being administered, delivered in chemtrails. At least that's what Vincent Freeman is speculating. Freeman is a molecular biologist and artificial intelligence scientist who's worked on classified programs, blah, blah, blah. Would you, and then they invite me to interview Mr. Freeman. I'll check out the videos. I just put two videos last week up on chemtrails and the issues of some of the sort of bioengineered nanoparticles that are in chemtrails. It's some of the more gruesome information that we have to deal with. And we did a great interview with Dr. Gwen Scott on action steps you can take to protect yourself from chemtrails. But I think, you know, some of that information describes the kind of environmental pollution we're dealing with and the importance really of detoxing and doing everything you can to build your immune system and stay detoxed. And there's some great Soleri reports on doing that with Dr. Laura Thompson that I would really encourage you to listen to, as well as that one with Dr. Scott. Dear Catherine, this is a solid article written by a medical doctor telling us how schools get more money for every additional child who is diagnosed with ADHD. Yes, that's true. There's tremendous financial incentives in the school system for getting people on, getting children on Ritalin. Here's a well-written article discussing some of the dire ramifications facing us on Agenda 21, and then an interview from Paul Craig Roberts on how expanding the war effort is important for increasing the political contributions to the politicians in Washington. That's true. One of the things that is unbelievably important is we need to create financial incentives, particularly for politicians, where they can make more money from peace than from war. Dear Catherine, global warming and climate change are subjects that have constantly been in the media in recent years, but whenever a scientist decides to question the science behind this, he or she usually cannot get on television to talk about it. With this in mind, and having heard words like carbon exchange, carbon-based currency, and carbon unit allotments for all of us as individuals being proposed, how much do you think that Mr. Global is really someone who's behind global warming and climate change? I think a lot, although I think climate change, we have problems in terms of space weather, our rotation around the sun, and also we are doing extraordinary environmental damage in terms of how we live. So I think it's climate change is a combination of things. I think a lot of the proponents of climate change, the way it's being done, is to try and sort of build political support for carbon taxes and greater political control using these topics as sort of an excuse. If you look at the Soleri model, what I had come up with in the 90s was a vision of people healing the environment through incentives to optimize equity. The carbon tax is basically the negative way to get there. You generate global revenues by controlling, and sort of driving expenses down through control. It tries to get at the same, you know, you try to get to the same place, but one is sort of the nice way to get there and the wealth building way to get there, and the other is sort of the depopulation way to get there. Quote from Dolan interview, if you study the train tracks of totalitarianism and how they were built out using the drug business, this is a quote from me in my interview with Dolan, and the war on drugs neighborhood by neighborhood, what you see in here when you go back and you study the people who are involved in doing it is you get some very fine and good, decent people who said we had no choice, we had to have a secret source of funding. The question was, based on what you said in the recent interview with Richard Dolan, does this mean that the Bush, Clinton, Iran, Contra, drug smuggling, MENA, Arkansas stuff was all in our best interest, and does that now make the Clintons and Bushes some of those good people? Ugh. I thank you for that question. I was referring to the people who made the initial decisions in the late 40s and early 50s. So the people who really went along with introducing it and building the infrastructure. So no, I wasn't referring to that gang whatsoever. Another question regarding the idea of financing derivatives backed by space technology and future space mining. Are these said derivatives off the books? Yes. I believe so. If so, wouldn't it also, if they exist, if so, wouldn't it also require that corresponding revenues and incomes and employment in this private space technologies be hidden? The companies themselves, for that matter. Some of it is. Remember, a lot of the money that's gone to fund this stuff has gone in sort of, you know, in secret ways. So it's covert cash flows, and it's tricky how they put things on the book. Remember, you had an executive order during the George W. Bush administration that basically gave the National Security Council the power to give waivers that allowed companies on their SECs reporting to not report honestly. So, you know, so in fact, you know, very good control point. What that meant was companies could take on enormous amounts of assets, built wildly valuable assets, you know, whether underground and in space, and not report them and still be within in compliance with SEC financial disclosure law. Or maybe they do include them, you know, who knows. The question continues. Maybe it is a net expense to this point, or some of those revenues showing up in the stock price of these companies, circulation of dollars much greater than we know. I do think that we're seeing these assets show up in companies that are traded in the stock market, and we're seeing values created in the stock market from the technology that's being engineered out of the black budget. Question continues. Maybe it's not even dollars, but a new space currency to replace the dollar, convertible to dollars. In the future, as Dr. Farrell would say, high octane, out on the limb speculation. Here's the basic premise, and they're referring to something that Joseph and I were talking about in our last interview. What we've watched for many years as the currency in this country is debased, we print dollars, then we expand the territory where the dollars can be floated. So as we go into Iraq, as we go into Afghanistan, when we went into Russia in the 90s, huge dollar float added. And so what you're literally seeing, and what Dr. Farrell was talking about, was the possibility that as we go into space, acquire more assets and potential territory, it's just a bigger base to float more dollars over. And I think, you know, now he was talking about the use of collateral to float, you know, float debt and other kinds of financial instruments. Again, high octane speculation, but very interesting to think about. Next question. I'm struggling to get a sense of who are these people. What do you think of G. Edward Griffin's suggestion? He suggested a multi-generational project started by Rusk and the Fabian Society, leading to Rhodes and Quigley, and finally the CFR, who he describes as a semi-secret outer ring of a very secret society. Here's Edwin Griffin's paper, Secret Organizations and Hidden Agendas, The Future is Calling. Does this view seem correct? You know, in a partial sense, if you haven't listened to, please listen to the two-part series, part one that I did on the breakaway civilization. The way I described it was I said, in the first part, this is part one, I will brief you on who is running things and what their concerns are. We will look top down from the global or G7 level, as well as from the viewpoint of the managers of large intergenerational pools of capital, such as pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, and pools of family and private syndicate wealth. We will also look bottom up from the viewpoint of an individual or head of household, the head of a small business or small town mayor. One of the things I would underscore is America is just 3,100 counties. And traditionally, if you looked at each county, it was the Masonic networks plus the Vatican networks, the churches, and the intelligence agencies in combination that really ran the system. And the, you know, and obviously the bankers were the Masons tended to be the bankers and the lawyers, and then share control of City Hall with the Vatican. And what you're seeing with the NSA surveillance system and why it's so important to understand how it works is it gives the intelligence agencies an upper hand in relation to the local Masons and the bricks and mortar churches. And that's part of what you're seeing is the local guys getting rolled in a whole variety of ways. Now, in the 60s, the Masons somewhat shifted into the university system. And with the squeeze coming in higher education, it's going to be interesting to see how they adapt. So it's a very, if you haven't read John Rappaport's book, The Secret of Secret Societies, that's also very helpful to understanding how incredibly over-networked and over-populated this control system is. It's quite intense, and they got every penny networked. It's quite unbelievable. So I would love to know with whom we are dealing. Well, this is the big question. The big question at the top, you know, what in the world is going on? What's really driving this? And that's the real question, because the power is coming top down, and it almost makes you wonder if the moon is a Death Star, because the whole planet and the financial system is clearly harvesting the whole planet. And so the question is, where in the world is this tithe going, and who's really in control? And the answer is, I don't know. That's one of the reasons I wanted to be part of the Secret Space Conference, because I think, you know, we need to illuminate that issue, to illuminate the question of governance. Our interview this week is with Lawrence Gonzalez. This is the second time he's joined us on the Solari Report. He's the author of one of my favorite books ever, Deep Survival: Who Lives, Who Dies, and Why. It's the story of extreme wilderness survival experiences, but you can discern from it powerful lessons that we all need. It's a life-changing book, and he's got several new books. One is Surviving Survival: The Art and Science of Resilience. And this is really about, okay, something terrible happens. It's a miracle. You make it. Now, how are you going to get over it? And it really gets into how we deal with trouble and who's successful dealing with trouble and coming back and living a happy life, as opposed to letting the memories of whatever they've overcome destroy them. And it's just a very, very useful book. One of the reasons I love talking with Lawrence is you're always inspired by the heroism and the unbelievable sense and natural cooperation and community that is in us all. He's got a new book that I'm dying to read. He's promised to send it to us, to all the members of the Solari team. It's called Flight 232, A Story of Disaster and Survival. And this guy's a beautiful writer and a very, very special person. And he's always inspiring to remind us of how many remarkable human beings there are. He makes you proud to be a member of the human race. Okay, that's it for this week. In closing, we've got some great stuff coming up. We're in a mood to be creative and positive. Next week, a fabulous interview with Peter Gurelnik, who's one of my favorite authors. He's a music historian. He wrote a 2-volume set biography of Elvis Presley that is the finest biography I've ever read. Now, you know, it probably ties with William Manchester's series on Churchill, which is also one of my favorite. It took Peter about 9 years to write them both. And if you love music, it takes you back into a moment when incredible soul and gospel and blues and rock and roll came together. It was part of the whole incredible musical renaissance that came out of West Tennessee, where I live, and produced Elvis Presley and many great musicians. And Peter has gone back and studied the history of much of the soul and rock era and folk as well. He teaches creative writing at Vanderbilt for one semester in the spring semester. And his knowledge of music and music as part of the American culture and American experience is fantastic. Now, I am unbelievably interested in the importance of music and the arts to economic revival and economic restoration. And I think music and arts are essential to the creation of healthy and successful places. So to me, I've always come at it from the economic development, you know, with my money hat on. Everything to me comes down to money. But it's a remarkable conversation about a remarkable period in our history and the music that made it. So Peter Gurelnik, a great conversation. Fresh Food with Jeffrey Smith. Jeffrey is the person leading the charge against GMO foods. What he has managed to accomplish is just absolutely astonishing. We've had him on the Solari Report when he published his documentary leading from his book, also called Genetic Roulette. If you haven't listen to that or seen that documentary, you absolutely want to see it. But he's going to update us on all the amazing things that are going on to protect and build our fresh food supply. And that's imperative to me. It is so important to me that you succeed and build wealth in this environment. You cannot do it unless you're healthy, you cannot build it unless your immune system is strong. You cannot build it if you're toxic. And it all begins with fresh food. So it's very important to me that you have fresh food and you have it on an affordable basis. And I think Jeffrey is somebody who's really trying to help make that happen. Then June 12th, Franklin Sanders will join us. We're going to talk about fructify, his verb for being a productive human. He's got two great books, Lessons Learned from Dogwood Mudhole 1 and 2. They're both out now. We're going to be talking to him about lessons learned from Dogwood Mudhole that you can use in your life to be productive. And we've got a lot of theories on what it takes to be successful in this environment. So we're also going to touch, of course, on precious metals. We can't have Franklin on and not do so. So until May 29th with Peter, and we'll be talking about music and rock and roll, including rock and roll that makes money in your place. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.